At the Commonwealth Policy Foundation, we try to approach the issues of life, marriage, religious liberty, and fiscal integrity from a biblical perspective that promotes thoughtfulness and kindness. We work with political leaders and concerned citizens from all across the state. To stay informed, visit commonwealthmatters.org and sign up for our e-newsletter. The Commonwealth Policy Foundation is a nonprofit organization that only exists because of friends like you. Thanks for tuning in to The Commonwealth Matters.
Welcome to The Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, Executive Director of the Commonwealth Policy Center. And joining me on the program today is Kentucky Commissioner of Education, Jason Glass. And full disclosure, Jason and I serve on the Council on Post-Secondary Education together, which is the coordinating agency for Kentucky Higher Ed. Jason, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Richard. I'm delighted to be here. Glad we were able to put it together.
Yeah. Hey, it was after one of our CPE meetings where you come and give an update, regular update on what's going on in K-12 schools. You said something, of course, public education has faced a lot of challenges, but you said something that really caught my attention, and it was about the necessity of us getting together around the First Amendment principles of freedom of speech and other founding ideals, and that was the gist of it. And I talked to you afterwards, and I'm like, man, I agree with you. And I want to start this program off by the reality of the political climate that we're in is challenging. And you have faced it, the public school teachers across the state have faced it, where there's a lot of vitriol, anger. A lot of our arguments are being hashed out on social media. And I think at the outset that it's important that we recognize that there are healthy ways to deal with things and unhealthy ways. And I guess I'll just say that social media is probably not the best way to solve big issues.
Absolutely right. Well, it's an instant feedback loop. We'll give it that. But sometimes people can post things and say things on there that they would normally never say in person.
Jason, you wrote an opinion piece last month talking about what's going on in public schools called "Seeing Teachers Thrive," and you share some startling numbers and trends. And quite frankly, again, the last 2 years have been tough. We've been in the pandemic for 2 years, shutdowns, remote learning has taken a toll, masks in the classroom have become controversial and divisive. What have we learned through this period? Are there some lessons that we can apply through this COVID shutdown, this time of pandemic?
The last couple of years have been tough on everybody, for sure. And they've been tough on our teachers also. Teaching is a tough job any time. And it's made even more difficult with all the disruption and starts and stops and safety requirements that have been that were put in place at the height of the COVID pandemic. Now we seem to be nearing the end of that. Thank goodness for everybody. But that brought a level of intensity to school, and now you've got global economic uncertainty. Looming crisis, not looming, it's here with Russia and the conflicts related to that. So there's just a lot of pressure that's on everybody. And those things come into our schools as well. Schools are not disconnected from the world and disconnected from society. All the challenges and problems that we have every day come into the school as well. So teachers have felt, I think, a lot of stress navigating all of that. So it's a tough job now on top of what's always been a really tough job.
You'd mentioned at one of your updates after the first year of COVID shutdowns that the next school year, which was last school year, there were 30,000 less children enrolled through K-12 education. Has that changed at all? I mean, that's the effects of it.
Yeah, I'd have to look at how that's moved most recently, but Kentucky's been experiencing a gradual decline in the number of students that are enrolled for some time, and I'm always hesitant to once in a lifetime we hope experience like we've had with COVID to prescribe trends based on that. So I think there's a lot that we don't know about what the long term effects of that will be. But I do think that we're stabilizing, and as you said at the outset, there should be things that we can all come together around. I've spoken with people across the political spectrum about what their aspirations are for their children, and I get answers that are remarkably similar. They want kids that are engaged and cared for at school. They want them to gain basic factual understanding of the things that they need as adults, and they want them to acquire skills like critical thinking, complex reasoning, problem solving, to be able to be successful in a lightning fast economy going forward. So there's a lot of things I think that if we could step back and take a breath that people say, I want this for my child. I want this for Kentucky's children. Yeah.
That's a good point. I want to add to that. In your column, you talked about the hyperpartisan climate that we're in. And then you say, if only we could get the public as excited about literacy or engaging students in meaningful learning experiences as much as they're excited about COVID-19 mitigation or banning classroom discussions. Those are important things to talk about literacy, right? Literacy is something that benefits the individual. Good learning experiences benefit the individual and society at large. So how do you... You know, it's not one. Literacy is not a hot button issue, right? It's not something that somebody's going to jump up and down about.
Well, if I knew that, I would have to consult with you to find the answer to that, I think. But I think one of the challenges that we've had just here emerging from COVID is that, you know, kids that have experienced across the world the greatest disruption to learning that our kids have in our lifetime, maybe in generations. And our priority needs to be on how do we support our kids with meaningful learning experiences over the next few years to recover from that and support our teachers through that. So for me, that is the education crisis that we face right now. How do we recover from all of that disruption? And while there's all kinds of political sparks that are made around all sorts of issues. For me, that's where the attention needs to be. How do we recover from the learning loss?
I wasn't planning on asking this, but I've had Dr. Aaron Thompson, the president of CP, on, and we talked about instilling a love of learning, which I think we're all born with that, this natural curiosity to learn about the world. We learn to speak at a young age, then we learn to read, and there's that natural curiosity that's there. And at some point, usually in late grade school, middle school years is when it seems like that love of learning dissipates. Mm. Something happens. Yeah. And by the way, I was one of those kids. Yeah. I was naturally curious. Yeah. I love to learn, love to read. But at a certain age, it's probably in junior high, high school, I'm just like, man, feels like I'm just going through hoops. And I got to the point, Jason, where I didn't really feel like I wanted to go to college. And yet my parents said, you need to go. My guidance counselor said, you need to go. And I went, and it kind of reluctantly. I wasn't excited about it. But here's the question, and you may not have an answer, but how do we keep that love of learning burning in our young people?
Right. There's an education theorist and futurist named Sir Ken Robinson, great thinker. He died just a couple of years ago. But he wrote a book about this and talked about it extensively. And his theory about why that happens was school. Is a direct cause of that because he pointed to kids growing up, and if you see a child when they encounter something new or something they don't really understand, they'll have a go at it. They'll take a shot and aren't afraid of trying something and failing. And then the experience of school really penalizes a failure or being wrong, and it places a high value on order and sort of behaving all in the same way at the same time. So there's a lot of rigidity to it. And so Ken Robinson's point really was that the experience of traditional schooling really wears the creativity out of kids and the risk-taking out of kids. And so I think going forward, what I'd love to see in Kentucky is that we think about reimagining school where instead of wearing that out of kids, we ignite it and we protect it and we try to find ways to help it grow. So I think if we look at the experiences kids have on a day-to-day basis, are we having them sit and be bombarded with and memorize content, which content certainly important, but what's a lot more important is what can you do with that information? Can you solve a problem? Can you be an innovator? Can you collaborate and work with people? Can you build relationships? So there's a whole host of skills that are a heck of a lot more important than just memorizing facts, especially in the era of you know, these things, where facts are really easy to get a hold of. But what becomes more important is sifting through them and learning what you can do with them and what their limitations are.
Recently, I interviewed the principal of Fulton County High School, small school. I think the last year the graduating class was less than 60 students. But one of the things they require is each of their students, beginning in their freshman year, I believe, have to take a course at the ATC, Area Technical Center. And this is where there's some kind of hands-on learning. There's automotive, there's welding. I think health, they have some in the health field. But for a graduation requirement, they have to have some kind of hands-on learning in order to graduate there. Mm-hmm. Half of the kids, it was over 50%, I believe, if I remember correctly, actually graduated with some kind of certificate or credential by the time they're 18, by the time they graduate. Is this something that maybe we should look at more in public schools? I know there's different school districts have different things like that, but is that what you're talking about? Different instead of just memorizing the facts or just sitting still?
I think career technical education is a great example of hands-on experiences. And you see a lot of kids who have struggled with the traditional school experience. When they finally get to the point that they can go to a career technical education experience, they really thrive because things make sense to them. And it's something that they can put their hands on and do. But I think that's one example of the kinds of shift we need. Another example of it that's present is performing or visual arts. Those are experiences kids get immersed in. You get instant feedback when you're singing and you hit a wrong note and others hear it, or you're singing with a group. You talk about accountability and you're off tempo or something. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of experiences are also hands-on and experiential. I think those kinds of lessons from career technical education or from performing or visual arts are the kinds of things that we should also think about. How can that kind of work transfer into traditional core content? So how can we create experiences in mathematics or social studies or science or English language arts that require students to interact with the content, but also solve a problem, do something hands-on, do something meaningful, authentic, engaging, real to them, so that we give them the chance to practice some of the same kinds of tasks that they'll have to do as adults. So I think while we can look to career technical education and something like music education as a great example for how that could be and what engagement could look like, we've got to think about how we can bring those same experiences into the other aspects of school that haven't been as engaging for kids.
So Jason, I'm going to pivot off of that, but it's related. Damon Thayer, majority leader in the Senate, talked about the need for people that come out of school with practical skills. There are 100,000 openings right now. You can see job openings everywhere you go. It seems that there's a balance between coming out of school with practical skills, hands-on skills, which is necessary. We need that. We want kids to come out with some kind of skill. And what you're talking about, the visual arts, music, the enrichment of the person. I'm thinking out loud and where I'm going with this, but there's that balance between that personal enrichment, knowledge for the sake of knowledge and developing yourself, and then practical hands-on or the ability to go into college and do something. Is there a challenge in our K-12 system to do both of those today?
Well, absolutely. And I think this is one of the polls on when you ask people what is the purpose of education or the purpose of public education, you get a lot of really different answers, all of which are good. The Fordham Institute did a study a few years ago where they asked thousands of people across the country, what is the purpose of public education? One of the top purposes that people listed was to help people get a job, right? That's a very pragmatic outcome, right? We need to be employable. But right behind that was the need for people to be able to participate as citizens in our democratic republic. Right behind that was the ability to interact with people who are different in a diverse society, respect and appreciate different points of view. Right behind that was the ability to appreciate arts and humanities and appreciate life and the beauty of living. So, there's a whole bunch of things that, depending on your perspective, public education is trying to do. All of them are good. All of them are right. And so I think part of what we've got to do is every child has talents, and they're all going pro in something. They've all got some ability. And the work of school really should be to try and help the student identify that and then nurture and grow that talent, that strength. We all have things that we're really good at. We really enjoy things that we want to spend our life pouring our energy into. Schools should be helping students identify those things and then carry that out of school and into life.
That's good. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson here with Kentucky Commissioner of Education Jason Glass. We're going to take a break and we'll be back in just a moment.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. It's clear that the news media isn't always fair. In fact, there's lots of far-left bias and political gamesmanship. No surprise there. So if you're looking for a perspective that's grounded in the truth of Scripture and our nation's founding principles, then get plugged into CPC's resources. Sign up for our e-newsletter at commonwealthpolicycenter.org. You can also follow us on Facebook at Commonwealth Policy Center. And we're on Twitter at CPC4Kentucky.
Commissioner Glass, it's good to have you on the Commonwealth Matters. I want to talk about the Kentucky education workforce facing challenges. You note in a column that you wrote recently that between 2008 and 2018, there's been a 37% drop in students who complete teacher training. Have you identified why that trend is moving in that direction? There's a teacher shortage to the degree that it's causing major disruption in many of our school districts across the state. What's going on with those college students who aspire to be a teacher, but they're not finishing teacher training?
Yeah, our institutions of higher education have been ringing that alarm bell for several years now. And they've been saying, we're seeing declining numbers, and we really haven't responded to that very well. We've always had shortages in math and science teachers, special education teachers, and we've always had a sort of a glut of applicants in social studies, physical education, and elementary education. Now what we're seeing is really shortages across the board, especially in rural areas, which is a big concern in Kentucky, where a rural school in Kentucky will post an elementary job. They're used to getting dozens of applications for that role. Now they're getting one or two. And they're having to choose whoever will take the job. Well, that doesn't set us up very well if you want to be selective about who is the teacher in the classroom, which we know is so important for the quality of learning. You really need more applications. So that's the beginning of our problem, is not enough people coming in. Some of that's been related to this is the national tenor of conversations around education, decreasing compensation and total compensation packages available to teachers, where young people look at what they can make as a teacher, as a college grad, versus other things that they could do with their lives. And they're rational people, and they make sound economic decisions. So they're choosing other things. So that's been happening. And then simultaneously, we are seeing the beginnings of an exodus of the current workforce leaving. We see it with superintendents and principals right now, who tend to be people that are later in their careers, that have maybe enough years to retire, so they've got options. And we just this year are starting to see greater numbers of resignations and people leaving that are in the teacher workforce. So whether or not that blows into a crisis, so in addition to not enough people in, are we losing teachers and educators at the same time? That, I think, will be the perfect storm if it all comes together. And it will really, I think, cause us to be awakened to the full-scale labor market crisis that we have in education. And that may be what it finally takes for us to take action. I hope it doesn't get to that, but the warning signs are all there. Certainly they're there on the income side, the number of people entering the profession.
Jason, the Kentucky legislature is in session. They passed House Bill 9, which was a funding mechanism for charter schools. It would create two pilot projects, one in Louisville, one in Northern Kentucky. Charter schools would have to be approved by local school boards. I was on Twitter, and fair warning, don't get on Twitter. We post commentaries on there every day, but I get Twitter updates. And once in a while, I take a look there. And I looked this morning, but there was a lot of public school teachers very upset about this funding. A friend of mine, Timmy Truitt, he's a principal down in a South Central Kentucky school. Good guy. But this is what he said. In my opinion, House Bill 9 is a vote against public education. And there are many opponents of charter schools that do believe it's going to destroy public education. Is that overstating? You know, surrounding states that have charter schools, Tennessee, Ohio, Indiana, Illinois.
Yeah, most other states.
Kentucky is one of the few that doesn't. We know that charter schools haven't destroyed public schools in other states. Other states that I just mentioned, their students perform better compared to Kentucky's students. So what's the concern?
I have sort of a radical moderate position on this, because I've worked in states with charter schools, directly with charter schools, mm-hmm. and I think they are not as bad and destructive as mm-hmm. the opponents say they are. Okay. And they are also not the panacea that the advocates for them say that they are. I don't think you can say that another state's performance is higher and therefore prescribed that's because sure. of the presence of charter schools. Mm-hmm. Charter schools are a mixed bag. There are excellent charter schools that I've had the opportunity to work with and be in that provide quality education. They're in it for the right reasons. They are have a passion for equity and serving all kids in the community, making sure that they're serving low-income, minority, kids with disabilities. So there are excellent charter schools. And then there are charter schools out there who are the complete opposite of that. They're either profiteering or they're trying to just skim off and educate the kids that are the easiest to educate and be really a publicly funded private school. So I do think it's a mixed bag. I think that as Kentucky's had a charter school law on the books for some years. They haven't had any charter schools come into being, in part because of the funding structure that's in place. There's an effort in this bill to change that. I'm still concerned about it. I'm not sure it's constitutional, but I think there is a way for the legislature to structure funding for charter schools. And I approach this very pragmatically, and that is we have a Republican supermajority. If they want to have charter schools in Kentucky, they can create the policy environment to create that coming into being. Where I come at this from really someone who has to call balls and strikes as I see them from what's good from a policy standpoint is if you're going to have charter schools, let's make sure that they are quality charter schools. And then if we're going to proliferate the number of schools and add more schools to the state, let's make sure that the ones that we're adding are quality and are available and really serving all kids. So that's the lens that I take on this.
Very good. Another education-related bill that's moving through the legislature is Senate Bill 138. This is the Teaching American Principles Act, sponsored by Senator Max Wise. I had a chance to sit down with him in his office, and one of the things that struck me about his bill, it's been dubbed a critical race theory bill. I don't agree with that. It does deal with it in a tangential way, but he said, you know, Richard, this is a bill that unifies. It teaches basic core American principles. Actually, this bill specifies that there are 24 primary source documents that are already taught in the elementary schools that should be taught in the middle and high schools as well. So it teaches those core principles that really unite us as Americans, the Constitution, Declaration of Independence. Even though we haven't lived up to those ideals always, Senator Wise says that this doesn't teach people what to think, but how to think. It would foster conversations when it comes to what is America about. And critical race theory, it is addressed in this in a end-around way, at least the original form. Now, I have not looked at the one that actually passed, but when I had interviewed him the other week, Senator Wise said that it did prohibit conversations that, and this is a paraphrase, that broad brushstrokes race and would guilt students based on race or ethnicity. That was my understanding. I don't know if that provision made it into this. I think it did. But this is a bill, I think, that those on the political left and those on the political right can perhaps gather around, in that it's teaching historical documents. You know, you think about what are those things that make us American? What are those ideals that are worth rallying around, that are good for all of us? The First Amendment, I think we can start there. Freedom of speech, freedom to assemble, freedom to petition your government. Those are things worth rallying. The idea in the Declaration of Independence, that we have a creator that endows us with inalienable rights, that means that we all have inherent dignity, inherent value. I think those are things that are good things that are taught in the schools.
Yeah, well, I want to give Senator Wise credit here because I think he has tried to reach across the political divide with this, which is not an easy thing to do. Doing so, you get accused by those on the right of sort of betraying the party line, and those on the left are skeptical of it. So it's a hard place to be to try and reach across the divide. But I think that's what he's tried to do. This bill is far better than the others that have been proposed in other states and what we've seen proposed here in Kentucky, in that in trying to sort of limit these concepts related to critical race theory, it doesn't do also bring with it censorship of ideas and discussions in classrooms. It doesn't threaten educators with losing their license or schools losing funding, which would have a chilling effect on conversations that take place. It doesn't legislate from the state house what can be taught in a classroom, which is a very autocratic educational approach. So I think there are some things that we should like better about this bill than other things that have been proposed. I've been very direct and straightforward with Senator Wise that I have some concerns about it. I think that one of the elements in it is it sort of lifts up the founding ideals, which, as you mentioned, we all should be able to rally behind. But it doesn't also present the full story of those, that when the founding fathers were talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, they weren't talking about that for everybody. They were talking about that for white men. And some people were still treated as property. Some people were disenfranchised. And they certainly weren't talking about women. So how do we can we tell the full story? I think in this bill, it does go on and say that that none of those conversations are censored or limited. Right. So, again, I appreciate that about what Senator Wise is trying to do with this. I also think there is a folly here. The 24 foundational documents, I don't have any problem with them. But when you try to legislate those from the state house, you instantly make that a political process, because that is a political process. Things that happen in committee chambers and on the legislative floor is curricular decisions that are happening through a political lens. And I don't know, even though these 24 documents may be good, where does that end, or what should or shouldn't be included? That really is, I think, a contextual decision, and it relates to what is the teacher and the students, what are they working on, what are the concepts. Even the one that's been sort of held up as the most controversial of these is Reagan's speech, right? Yeah, I would have no problem teaching Reagan's speech, A Time for Choosing. But it has to be put in the context of the Goldwater election and the Cold War. And you have to lay it against Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society speech. Like, there's a whole bunch of other things you have to put with that to make it make sense. So I think one of the challenges is when we start from a political process, identifying here's what has to be taught. Even though I think this is a better bill than what we've seen, I think that a teacher still has to take that and think about, what can I put with this so that it makes sense to a student, so they get the full picture.
Yeah, no, I think those are good points, points well taken. Jason, I wish we could talk more, but we are out of time. I really do appreciate you joining me for the Commonwealth Matters.
Hey, it's been fun, Richard. Thank you. All right.